Today is the second day of the 2016 7-day retreat in Springwater. Yesterday, in group dialogue, one of the central themes running through the discussion related to sticky thoughts. Maybe, what is it that hooks us? What kinds of thoughts hook us? Or what kind of thoughts do we tend to engage with or attach ourselves to? Looking here, those kinds of thoughts tend to come or are a result of an image, which basically is a collection of thoughts about oneself that has been hardwired into our brain from many different kinds of experiences. Something to hold on to. It tends to come up when maybe there's a feeling of discomfort, a feeling of unworthiness, and then something needs to be held on to in order to feel that one is something and not nothing. Or different kinds of situations like that. And some of us may have glimpses here and there where we see that it's all the mechanisms of thought that we believe to be true, but in fact are not. It's just empty. And that can be seen for oneself in a given moment or space of time. I remember a talk that Tony gave, maybe it was the last retreat, I don't remember. And, you know, it was a tape talk I listened to, but she talked about being enclosed in a room with just a little opening to look that you can look through. And that room that you're enclosed in is really that the image of ourselves. And when one sees or glimpses into the reality that is just thoughts. It's just thoughts that have congealed together from who knows where, from lots of experiences in the past, still operating. And when that wall drops away, there's no barriers. There's a sense that there's nothing between you and something. It's just all here. And there's a sense of freedom, because there's no need to be holding up this image, which is really limiting our ability to really be here in this moment or in our interactions with people. But somehow, even though we may have glimpsed into this, the thoughts still creep back in. Those thoughts will creep back in. But when they do, they don't hold the same amount of weight as they once did, because one has seen the emptiness. So when they come back in, they don't grip in the same way. And so in any moment, it can be seen. That's the beauty of all of this, that you can see these things when they come up. And so when the thought comes up, and maybe one's mulling around in it for a while, and then once sitting and wondering, what is this? Where is this coming from? What is this? And really question and be with it. It's kind of like falling through space with nothing to hold on to and seeing that there's something that we want to hold on to. That's kind of just came to me earlier. It feels like just falling and wanting to grab something, but there's nothing to hold on to. And can you stay with that nothing to hold on to? Or see that one is grasping to hold on to? All that can be seen. And what is there? And I was looking at this, you know, this habitual, as someone had brought it up as habitual, these thoughts almost come up habitually because they're so wired in us. And I know there's people here like myself who work in a school. It's so obvious when you're in that kind of setting to see how all this stuff is perpetuated. Of course, you can see it anywhere, just in yourself, it coming up and how it, in parenting or whatever. But it's so keenly obvious in the school. In the last couple of weeks, my school has been engaged in preparing the students for the big high-stakes test that's coming up in April, I think. And so they've been conducting these practice tests, where they are basically putting the kids through the same experience that they would be going through for the real test. It's 3 days of one sub ELA and another 3 days of math. And the school went, I mean, they have used to sell these shirts that they wanted the staff to wear, which say, learn it, know it, show it. And I refused to, I had the excuse that like, I didn't want to buy one of their shirts, I didn't have the money, whatever, because I really didn't want to wear their shirts. So then the administration came up with, they're going to buy shirts for everyone, including the custodians. and strongly encouraging us to wear these shirts that say, learn it, know it, show it. And you wonder, like, what kind of message is that to the kids? What kind of pressure is that putting on the kids? To know it, to learn it, to know it, and to show it. And this whole thing of knowing, needing to know, and having to know, and being nobody, nothing, if one doesn't know. And then I know that if I was one of those children, I would be failing every single test, whether I knew the material or not. Because in the moment when you're sitting there under this pressure of having to show something, and how the stakes are so high, and the tension of the teachers, because if the students don't do well on these tests, the state won't give money to our school, and the school is done for. So the pressure is among the children, among the teachers, among the administrators. It's everywhere. And it's all about knowing some particular information, and that's somehow a measure of someone's intelligence. And if one doesn't have that intelligence, then one is no one. Nobody, or just no good. So just from this one little example, we see how this stuff is impressed upon us as children. And we can even see how this stuff even comes out at us and is impressing on others when we're not looking, when we go into autopilot and need to defend this image of what? When that is seen, and you can see how this stuff is perpetuated within oneself and within others, that's where this work is really has meaning. Because when that stuff drops away, then potentially there's no harm being done. When one can truly be here and present and watch the reactions that come up, maybe see them before it comes out. And it's all coming from this very believed ideas about ourselves, which are not who we really are, but just what we think we are. This is something that we can discover for ourselves. It's not something that I can tell you what that is. It's something you need to see and look if you're interested in finding that out. That's the only way any real change can come about. Something else that just sort of came up. My daughter, who's been grieving the loss of her young husband, she sent me this text image this morning of a cake that she made with a good friend who's been with them, a high school friend who's living down in Baltimore where her and Louis were living. And they have been spending a lot of time cooking. It's something, I don't know, it's been kind of therapeutic. And Sally and Louis used to do a lot of cooking. They were very into cooking and preparing food before Louis got sick. And so for Valentine's Day, they did a picture of she sent me this image of a cake that they made, a photograph. It's a white cake, and in the center of it was this beautiful heart made out of nuts, it looked like. And it brought to mind, I don't know why, it just sort of brought to mind experience. I spent a lot of time caring for Louis while he was sick with cancer over the last year. And while I was there, a couple of times, but the second time when I was there, he would be getting these infections, and then his fever, and we'd have to take him to the emergency room, and we all hated to do that, and it had happened so many times, and it was a Friday evening, and I had spent all day in the clinic with him, and we came back, and he had a fever, and no one wanted to go to the emergency room. So, although we knew probably we would have to at some point. So, we lay down on the couch and Louis decided we would vote on it. So we all voted that we would wait. And, you know, it's life-threatening, potentially, with the fever. So Friday evening, going to the emergency room at that time of day, would just have been horrible. So we decided to wait, and we went to sleep. And around 4 o'clock, Sally woke me up and said, his fever's come back, we need to go. So it was very quiet. We got up and it was 4:30 in the morning, even in Baltimore, it was relatively quiet. And we got into the car. It was very calm, driving down St. Paul Boulevard, and only thing that was around were there were these women of the night walking around. It was kind of interesting. So we got to the hospital, and it was very quiet. He went to the pediatric ER, because that's where his doctors are with pediatric oncology. So we went in there, and we were put in a room with all kinds of equipment, and the nurses were attending to him. And And so Sally and I sat in there. He kind of fell asleep in and out, but Sally and I were sitting in these chairs, not even as comfortable as the chair I'm sitting in. We sat there for 7 hours. And Sally was falling asleep with her head on the end of the bed, and you know, I was sitting there looking at all the stuff that was coming up, like, oh, how much longer? Is the nurse going to come in? And realizing that there was really no real escape. It's just sitting there. And it wasn't pleasant, put it that way. And I guess my point I was trying to make about all of this is that sometimes unpleasant experiences are unavoidable, or what we think are unpleasant experiences, or painful experiences, are unavoidable. Yet we come up with stuff to try to move away from the experience. Either we can get angry thoughts about why do I have to be here, or why don't they come in, why can't they get us a room right away. You know, you can get into all those kinds of thoughts about that, which actually makes the experience even more unpleasant. So what is there? There's just being with that. Being in this room, in this uncomfortable chair, and sitting there, and looking at Louis, and looking at the instruments, and feeling the tiredness. And then, finally, Louis was moved into a room, and Celeste and I, who were very hungry at this point, went to this French pastry shop, and we sat down and we got this piece of quiche, and I remember feeling such incredible joy at being in this place and enjoying this cheesecake, I mean this quiche that tasted like incredible. And I said to Celeste, you know, it just feels so good just to be here, eating this quiche. And I wonder if that quiche would have been so good if I hadn't gone through this 7 hours of sitting in this room with instruments. So these painful, unpleasant experiences that are part of life, how do we meet those experiences? And in meeting those experiences, is it more possible to be with all the experiences, positive or wonderful experiences? Are we fully alive in those experiences, or in this experience? It feels like it's more possible to be fully alive even in wonderful moments and appreciating every moment. Is that what life is really about? Just being with whatever is from moment to moment. I took a little short walk down to the waterfall before the talk, and most of it was completely frozen over. And yet there were these little openings, and the water was rushing through. That vital energy is here to be felt. One of the things I love the most about coming here to Spring Waters is taking walks and noticing how every time I come, the landscape is different. It's a different climate, a different something. It's always new and different. I've come to start jotting down little notes of what I notice when in my walks. And I thought maybe I'd end this talk with one of my little notes that I wrote last, maybe it was the January retreat when I was here. Snow-covered branches of bare trees line the field. A ray of sunlight coming out of a cloud passes by. The wind howls while the dead goldenrod and grasses whistle and bend. Where is the pain and sorrow of this world? I will end the talk here.